Hey, good morning, everybody. Welcome to Bio 231, the Wednesday edition, July 1st. And don't forget, this is the last lecture of the week because tomorrow is part of 4th of July holiday weekend, right? So there's no school tomorrow. But nonetheless, you still should not forget about something. There's still something that you have to do during the holiday weekend. What is it that you still have to do or you lose course points? Yeah, the online weekly quiz, right? That's still going to be due Friday at 11 p.m. If you haven't done it already, get it out of the way so that you don't forget about doing it. And remember, there's two quizzes in there, right? There's A and B. And I forget what week is it. Let me take a look and see what week it is. It is week 3, is that right? Yeah, week 3. So there's a week 3A, week 3B quiz. All right, so we are July 1st. We're going to get into skeletal muscle tissue. And tell me, what is muscle tissue specialized for? Contraction. And in particular, skeletal muscle tissue, when it contracts, what moves? Your skeleton. And that's why it's called skeletal muscle, right? And you have voluntary control of your skeleton. So skeletal muscle is what we call voluntary muscle, unlike cardiac and smooth muscle. All right, so July 2nd, tomorrow, it's a 4th of July holiday, no school. And then we do come back on Monday, July 6th, and we're going to start looking at some muscles of the body. And that for Monday and Tuesday, then Wednesday, we have our second exam. So that second exam is exactly 1 week from today. And that's going to include chapters 7 through 11 continuously. Yep, every single chapter in between. So 7, 8, 9, 10, and 11. And, of course, here are the page numbers that you should look over. And does anybody have a question on the schedule? All right. If I recall correctly, the lab schedule calls for a quiz on Monday. There's no lab quiz today, but there is on Monday. And then on Monday, Tuesday, and then on Thursday is your second practicum in lab. All right, and I hope you all do as well as you did on the first one. That was great. And on July 7th, which is Tuesday, and July 8th, which is Wednesday, Jessica will be in lab to help answer questions as well. But you can see her over in the LRC anytime from when? 8 to 6, something like that. And you can call ahead to make sure that she's available. But there are bones over there. There might be some muscles over there as well. All right, so that's the schedule as far as I know in totality. So let's go to joints. We still were finishing up some stuff on joints. So we learned different kinds of joints. Sometimes we classify them by their shape, right? Sometimes we want to think about them in terms of their structure. They have different names. I mean, their structure and shape is the same thing. Sometimes we want to know something about them in terms of their function, but of course, if you know their shape, you pretty much know what their function is because there's a relationship between them. But depending on what you want to emphasize in your discussion, you would pick one point of view or the other. And probably the joint that we're most interested in here is a synovial joint. And what can you tell me about the structure of a synovial joint compared to a suture, which is a ligamentous joint? What can you tell me about a synovial joint? It's a little bit complicated. It's got all these little pieces right here. But because it has hyaline cartilage over the epiphyses, and there's synovial fluid, which helps bathe the hyaline cartilage, keeps it healthy, and the synovial fluid in the joint capsule comes from the synovial membrane, which is protected by the fibrous capsule. So if we put the fibrous capsule, synovial membrane together, we get the joint capsule, right, or articular capsule, and then what strengthens the joint even a little bit more is that there are ligaments. There's strengthening ligaments that actually span that particular joint. So this is a pretty important exam figure. And synovial joints, or some synovial joints, might have an additional feature, might have some fibrocartilage between the sheets of hyaline cartilage on the epiphyses. And in the knee, can you remember what we call those things? That's a meniscus, right? A knee meniscus. All right, so that's a typical synovial joint And let's see, is there anything else I want to say again? Well, we looked at tendon sheaths and bursa. Those things kind of remind me of a synovial joint because they have a synovial membrane. It's like a pillow filled with synovial fluid, which helps reduce inflammation and friction in a joint, or where a tendon moves very close up against a muscle or a bone, so that prevents inflammation. All right, and where we ended last time, we're talking about movements. And this is really nice because I haven't been able to use these definitions in the class so far, and it's really hard to talk anatomy without knowing some basic terminology, right? Like protraction, dorsiflexion, supination, that kind of stuff. All right, so what we looked at last time right here is flexion and extension. And that's a really good place to start. And I'm going to turn some lights on. So a good place to start with flexion and extension is to imagine a straight line. So here's a straight line. Here's the middle of that straight line. And so what is this angle between this first segment and second segment? Yeah, it's a straight line, so it's what? 180 degrees. And if this straight line over here on the right moves up, okay, to this location, right, and I don't even know what number that would be, but we could probably guess. That's not so important. But when the joint starts to bend in this direction, and this angle is what? It's less than, right? It's less than 180 degrees. What do we call that motion? Okay, when the angle between two parts of your body decreases, that is flexion. All right, that is flexion. And as a matter of fact, even if it comes way up over here, right, then that is still flexion. One nice thing about flexion is that it has an antagonistic motion, right? If we increase the angle between these two body parts, we call that extension, right? So flexion and extension. We looked at the arm last time and the elbow. So when I move my forearm so that it comes closer to my arm, we call that flexion because the angle is decreasing. We increase the angle, that is extension. And there are two different muscle groups responsible for that. They're opposite motions. The muscle groups are on opposite sides of the body. That's going to be really key for you to appreciate. So flexion is due to muscles that are in your anterior arm. Extension is due to muscles that are in your posterior arm. So there's really nice symmetry there. All right, so let's use that example of flexion and extension to see something about the vertebral column. All right, so here's a person standing straight up. Their head is right in line with their hips, their knee, their ankles, right? That's just a nice straight line. And if somebody bends over forward, then this angle is decreasing. The angle of their vertebral column is decreasing. So what do we call that motion when the angle decreases? That is flexion. Yeah, that is flexion. And then when you stand back up straight, that is extension. That's extension of the vertebral column. So that's pretty easy to understand. And here is something your back can do that your elbow cannot do, and that is from this 180-degree position, if you lean backwards, we call that hyperextension. Hyperextension. So that you can do that with your back to some degree, but can you hyperextend your elbow? Not without breaking something. Okay? So some joints you can hyperextend a little bit, and some you cannot. Of course, your cervical spine, you can flex very nicely, and you can extend very nicely, right? And even hyperextend. Okay, so again, just use that model of that 180-degree line. And those are antagonistic motions. And what's the beauty of having antagonistic mechanisms controlling some part of your body? What does it confer to you in terms of control? All right, so jot this down. Precise control and balance. That's right, balance. That's really important. Okay, and you're going to find that to be important not just for the musculoskeletal system, but for the endocrine system, nervous system, and a whole bunch of other systems. It's just inherently built into the musculoskeletal system, but in the nervous system, evolution has had to go through a number of gyrations and important improvements in order to get a nervous system working in an antagonistic way. All right, so let's look at the hip joint. All right, so, and forget about my leg. I'm not going to move my leg just the way it should be, but just think of my thigh, right, and my torso at my hip. Tell me what this motion is between my thigh and my torso. That's flexion, right, because I'm decreasing the angle. 180 degrees, 90 degrees, that's flexion. All right, what about that motion from up here to down here? That is extension, and what about that? Hyperextension, right? You can't hyperextend the hip. Okay, so that one is easy for me to see. There is another important joint where those rules that we talked about, to me, is very obscure. I don't understand the rule at all. And that is at the shoulder. Okay, so at the shoulder, just think of my arm, not the forearm. This motion right here, I don't see an angle changing, really. All right, I don't see an angle changing. That's what we call flexion. Okay, so flexion, when you elevate your arm in front of you like that, that is flexion. When you bring it back down to your side, that is extension. And then when you move it past your back, that is hyperextension. That's easy to do with the shoulder just because of the joint, right? So flexion, extension, hyperextension. How are you going to remember that? Well, if you can just memorize, that's fine. But the way I remember it is that I always compare my shoulder to my hip, right? And it obeys the same kind of rule. So what is this at the hip once again? Flexion, and this is extension. So what is this at the shoulder? Flexion, do you see how it compares very nicely to the hip? And so this is extension, hyperextension. So that's probably one way that you can remember at the shoulder, at least those two motions. And if you see another way of appreciating that when you move your arm anteriorly, that's flexion, and when you bring it back down, okay, that's extension or hyperextension. And then here at the knee, it's probably pretty easy to see. All right, so not at the hip, but at the knee. So when somebody's standing straight up, it's 180 degrees. When you bend at the knee, bringing your heel back behind you, that's flexion. And then when you bring your leg back down straight, that would be extension. And the knee, aha. Let's take a look at this. All right, so at the knee, what motion is this? I don't know if you can see. That's flexion. Here is extension. What about hyperextension at the knee? You can, but you'll break something, right? So please appreciate what joints you can hyperextend and which ones you can't. All right. Abduction and adduction. That one's pretty easy. These are antagonistic motions. Adduction and abduction, easiest to appreciate with your upper appendage and lower appendage. In anatomic position, your hands are down by your sides, right? And if you were to move your hands away from midline, like this, we call that abduction. Moving away from midline, abduction, bringing your hands like this toward midline, that is adduction. So it's like adding your arms to your body is adduction. You can do that with your legs. Abduction, adduction, bringing them together. There are muscles that abduct and muscles that adduct, and they are on opposite sides of the body, just like I mentioned for flexion and extension. Circumduction is kind of a fancy motion that can be accomplished with a ball and socket type joint, which we're going to look at in a second. And the shoulder and the hip are both ball and socket type joints. And so at the shoulder, you can, let's review, we can flex, we can extend, can hyperextend, we can abduct, adduct, and we can do all kinds of motions in between, right? So if we do all the motions in between, then we're making like a big windmill motion. And that's what we call circumduction. And you can only do that with a nice ball and socket joint. Another kind of motion is rotation. We talked about rotation in lab. For instance, of your head, you can rotate your head laterally to the left, laterally to the right. That's a rotation, right? So a right lateral rotation, left lateral rotation. And at what joint can you rotate your head? There's a specific joint, okay? It's between C1 and C2. Yep, is where rotation is allowed, but not between the occipital bone and C1. At that joint, it's only flexion and extension. Oh, it's so nice to be able to use those terms, flexion and extension, right? Instead of the yes motion and no motion. All right, so rotation in cervical spine is possible, but you can also rotate your humerus. And this motion is used diagnostically a lot. And so I'll just rotate my humerus in my shoulder like so, but there's a better way to observe it, and that is to flex at the elbow. Go ahead, flex your elbow, and what do you see? Like that, okay? So I'm just going to keep my wrist stationary, all my digits stationary, my forearm stationary after I flex it like that. How are you going to see rotation of the humerus? All right, so lateral rotation is like that. Medial rotation is like that. So now can you get a better impression of what bone is actually moving? It is the humerus that is rotating. Not the forearm. Forearm is moving, but that's only because it's attached to the humerus, right? So medial rotation, lateral rotation, and there are a bunch of muscles that go over the shoulder joint, and if any of those muscles are damaged because they're so integrated into the shoulder fibrous capsule, when the muscles are damaged, it damages the fibrous capsule of the shoulder joint. That's called a rotator cuff tear. Pretty common type injury. A very easy way to diagnose that is to see if somebody can do a lateral rotation with that particular arm. So how would you check somebody's lateral rotation? Tell them to bend at the elbow, and if they know what flexion is, that would be really nice. And then put your hand laterally and see if they can exert any pressure on your hand, right, if they can push on your hand. And if they can't, if they're experiencing excruciating pain, that's a really nice sign that there's a rotator cuff injury. If they can apply pressure to your hand, that means that's a pretty good indication that they don't have a rotator cuff tear. But of course, you would want to confirm that with some kind of imaging or other kinds of diagnostics as well. All right, so all these motions are really important to know if you're going to understand something about somebody's musculoskeletal system, besides just talking anatomy. All right, so that's a rotation. Supination and pronation. This has to do with the forearm. Let's see if I have a slide with... Oh, here's abduction, adduction. That's nice. Circumduction, we talked about. Rotation. All right, here we see it of the head, cervical spine. Here we see it of the humerus. So here is that axis of rotation up here in the shoulder. It's easier to see if you flex your elbow first, right? At least for me it is. And... elevation, depression, protraction, retraction. Ah, here we go. Okay, so here I see two hands. First one I see the palms, and the other one I see the back of the hand. And we're looking right at this person, so which hand is in anatomic position, correct anatomic position? The one on the left or the one on the right? The one on the right. Good. I don't know if that's really obvious or not, but I like that you can see that. So the thumb is pointing laterally, right? And in anatomic positions, for sure, the palm of your hands are facing anteriorly. And you can turn your hand so that it faces posteriorly. And when that happens, let's look at these two bones in the forearm. The lateral bone is the... What's this lateral bone? Here's thumb, so it's lateral. What's the lateral bone in the forearm? Radius. And the medial bone is the ulna. Okay, but because of that fancy joint in the elbow, the capitulum and trochlea, these bones can rotate around each other. Can't see it on this figure, but they rotate around each other. So that when the palms of your hands are facing posteriorly, notice that the radius and ulna are no longer parallel to each other. They actually cross over each other. All right, so the radius crosses over the ulna, and that's why we don't like to consider that anatomic position, even though that's a very nice, relaxed way to put your hands, right, where they cross over. All right, so if you start in anatomic position and you move the palms of your hands so that they face posteriorly, palms posteriorly, we call that pronation. So all the P's kind of line up. If you move your hands so the palms of your hands are facing anterior, then we call that supination. So right now my hands are supinated because my palms are facing anteriorly. And if you put your hands together, what can you make? You can make a soup bowl, right? So that may be one way you could remember, supination, right, versus pronation. So think palms of the hands facing posteriorly is pronation, hands facing anteriorly, you make a soup bowl. We call that supinated. The motion going from one to the other is called supination or pronation. Who's got a question on that? How'd I do? Could you kind of see what's going on there? Okay. And that's because of that fancy elbow joint, which you have to know a lot about. Like, for instance, what do you have to know about the elbow joint? in the forearm, laterally, you got the radius. Medially, you got the ulna. So let's go back to the radius. The head of the radius articulates with what part of the humerus? A special condyle and that distal epiphysis of the humerus, the head of the radius interacts with. And that is the capitulum. Right? And the trochlear notch in the ulna articulates with another condylar surface, which is not the capitulum. The trochlear notch in the ulna articulates with the trochlea. All right, so that over the weekend, make sure you have a good picture in your mind and then you can talk about it. Right? So even in the mirror in your bathroom, look at yourself and say that. Okay, radius articulates with the capitulum. Ulna articulates with the trochlea. And that's why on the radius, on the ulna, you got the trochlear notch. Okay? All right, so take a look at those. That's what we talked about last time. Dorsiflexion and plantar flexion. These are motions at the ankle. And here they are right here. All right, so here is the axis of rotation, moving right to left at the ankle. If you point your toes into the ground, not your toes, but if you move your foot so that your toes go into the ground, we can see the toes are going into the ground, and that is what we call plantar flexion. So if I were to plantar flex right now, what would happen to my body? Yeah, it would go up, right? And when I relax, okay, if I raise my toes off the ground, like so, probably can't see that, my body isn't really moving, my toes are moving a little bit, they're getting up off the ground, that's dorsiflexion, right? So plantar flexion, dorsiflexion. And those are antagonistic motions, so we would find muscles on opposite sides of your leg that produce dorsiflexion or plantar flexion. The plantar flexors are in your posterior leg. All right, so plantar flexors are in your posterior leg. Where would you find muscles for dorsiflexion? In your anterior leg. Just flip the body over. Okay? Doesn't seem really obvious to you at the moment, but it's really, really simple. And you really want to understand muscle motions that way because it will make it a whole lot easier. You won't have to memorize a lot of stuff. All right, so let's talk about dorsiflexion. I'm dorsiflecting. I'm raising my toes off the ground. Now I'm plantar flexing. Which group of muscles do you think are bigger and stronger? The ones that dorsiflect in the anterior leg or the ones that plantar flex, which are in the posterior leg? Okay, posterior leg, right? Because when you plantar flex like I'm doing right now, what do those muscles have to do? They have to raise your whole body up, right? All that weight. But if you're going to use the dorsiflexors, muscles only have to raise your toes up off the ground, a lot weaker, okay? Okay, and for sure you'll notice that in athletes. You might see some people riding bicycles on the side of the road or jogging or whatever, and their calf muscles are really strong and hypertrophied because they are using a plantar flexor motion with a lot of power to move their body around. Okay, and again, it's really nice to know something about these different motions. For instance, you might go see a doctor sometime, or your grandma, parents, or whatever. And it used to be when doctors had a lot of time, they would be in their office and the patient would walk into the office. And as the patient is walking into the office, the physician most times would be able to diagnose what the problem was just by looking at the patient, seeing how they're walking and all kinds of stuff. Now they don't do that. They put you in a room and the doctor walks in. So the doctor can't really see what's going on with you. But if you can observe somebody walking, here is something that's really important to notice. Okay? And probably a lot of physicians still do this. Veterinarians do this as well. They'll look at the tips of a person's shoes, right? The very point of their shoes. And if they see the tips of the shoes are worn out, what does that mean? When somebody's walking, what are they doing? They are like dragging their toes over the ground because they can't. What motion are they not doing if their toes are dragging over the ground? They are not dorsiflexing. Okay, and it doesn't require very strong muscles to do that, right? So there is some kind of disorder that's happening right there, and it's really important to know because as you drag your toes over the ground, what is possible for you to do? Trip on something, right? And if you're in our age group, then of course we can kind of catch our balance before we fall, but if you're 80 years old or 85, 90 years old and you trip like that, you're going to fall. And when we're that old, our bones are brittle, easy to break a hip, right? And that's probably one of the least significant things that can happen. You can actually fracture your neck when you fall, right? That could be a lethal incident just when that happens. But if you break a hip at that age, you can't heal at home. You get put in a nursing home for convalescence, and a lot of people just kind of lose the will to live when that happens, right? So a tripping incident can actually be a fatal episode for somebody's life because they're detached from their family and all that kind of stuff, right? And so just a real simple observation of somebody's shoe tips because they cannot dorsiflect, right, can actually maybe save somebody's life. That's also an indication that there's a problem in somebody's spinal cord or back. Right, so there's just a lot of really nice information you can get by understanding what these motions are. Right, so, and a good place for you guys to start is what? Learning the basics. Plantar flexion, dorsiflexion. And once you know all these different motions, then you'll just be aware and learn a whole bunch of stuff about why they are important. Right? Okay, dorsiflexion, plantar flexion. Inversion and eversion, oh, I hate to even talk about this one, okay? Again, it has to do with the ankle. Here's the axis of rotation, so your foot is either going to move medially or laterally. If you bend your ankle so that you're standing on the lateral side of your foot over here, okay, well, too bad you can't see my foot, but if you're going to stand on the lateral edge of your foot like that, that's called inversion. That's easy to do. There aren't a lot of ligaments that prevent that from happening. When somebody sprains their ankle, usually it's an inversion. When somebody roll their ankle, okay, it's an inversion. If you go the opposite way, like trying to stand on where your big toe is, that's eversion. It's more difficult to evert your foot. It's protected with more ligaments. Rarely you don't sprain an ankle doing that. But if you do roll your ankle with an eversion type motion, it's a much more damaging kind of motion for you to go through. Okay, so inversion, eversion. Protraction, retraction. There are some parts of your body, okay, that you can move anteriorly and you can move posteriorly. You can do that with your shoulders. You can move your shoulders anteriorly. We call that protraction. You can move your shoulders back. That is retraction. And you can also do it with the mandible, but be careful. I don't want you to break a tooth. You can poke your jaw out anteriorly. You can move your mandible anteriorly like that. All right, that's protraction. Or you can move it in toward your spine. That is retraction, protraction and retraction. That's not the only thing you can do with the mandible. Right? You can open your mouth. You can move your mandible inferiorly. We call that depression. You can close your mouth. You can move your mandible superiorly so your mouth closes, right? And so we call that elevation. And you can do that with your shoulders as well, right? You can elevate, right? You can depress, right? You can protract, you can retract. Just because that scapula is highly mobile, has a lot of muscles around it. So protraction, retraction, elevation, depression. Again, these are antagonistic motions. And here is a fancy motion, okay, because of a joint in your thumb, and it is called opposition. Interesting. Let's go. Okay, here's opposition. In anatomic position, your thumb is laterally. You can move your thumbs anterior like that and then pinch up against another digit, like digit number 2. All right, we call that opposition. It's for grasping. Opposition with your thumb, and that's the only joint where opposition can take place in your body because of that particular joint. All right, so who's got a question on these motions right here? Anybody have a question on these motions? Pretty good. So what's the hardest one? Pronation, supination, ab and adduction, pretty easy. Inversion, eversion. Unless you're an athlete and kind of know something about that, that might be hard to know. Dorsiflexion, plantar flexion. All right, and when we get into muscles, wow, we got to be just really familiar with these different kinds of motions. Okay. All right, so look at it and ask me if you have a question later. Okay. So a joint will be able to move properly in a certain way if the structure of the joint will allow it, right? So the function of that joint is determined by what kind of structure it is. And so here are some joints listed by their shape or their structure. And knowing their shape, we should know something about what their function is. Okay, a plane joint or transitional. It's a joint between tarsals and carpals. Where do you have your tarsals? Where do you have tarsals? In your foot. And where do you have your carpals? Yeah, in your hand. Let's go. All right. All right, so here are your carpals, and here are some pretty flat joints right in this region right here. These are plane joints. There's no rotation. They just kind of slide around past each other, right? And there's really no axis of rotation or motion. They just slide backwards and forwards, right and left. That's what we call a gliding joint. Gliding joint or a plane joint are the same thing, right? Bones of the ankles, bones of the wrist. Another kind of joint is a hinge joint. There is an axis of rotation, right? It's a uniaxial motion, like a door opening and closing or a joint flexing and extending. A really good example of that would be, for instance, the elbow, where you can flex the forearm and extend the forearm. And the knee, you can flex the knee, extend the knee. That would be a really good example of a hinge joint. And let's see what we got for a hinge. Oh, here's a good hinge. Right, uniaxial, there's only one axis of rotation, and at the elbow, it's between, the trochlear notch in the ulna and the trochlea. That's just a hinge joint. That's a perfect example of a hinge joint, right, as modeled right here. Uniaxial motion, only one way you can move that joint. A pivot joint. All right, so here's a pivot joint, and again, an elbow, we said, is a pretty fancy joint because the radius can actually cross over the ulna, and that's because the head of the radius fits into this little facet right here on that proximal epiphysis of the ulna. And can anybody remember what this little smooth surface on the ulna is called? Right here. It's pretty easy to remember, but you got to visit it a couple times. All right, so this, tell me what the name of this bone is right here, where I have the cursor. That's the ulna, right? That's the ulna. Here is a feature on the ulna. Here we have a depression or a fossa, right? And there's a smooth surface. It's kind of a condylar surface. Would we want to name this feature on the ulna, incorporate the name of this feature on the ulna, ulna? Do we want to say this is the ulnar notch? And the answer is you don't. You want to name this feature on the ulna by the name of the bone that is interacting at this location, just like we did the zygomatic arch, right? So this little feature on the ulna is called the radial notch because the radius fits into it, okay? And here we can see that the radius actually rotates. Here's the axis of rotation. It's a uniaxial motion as well, and that is a rotation for supination and pronation. Now don't forget, down at the distal end of in the wrist joint, there the head of the ulna is nice and circular and fits into a nice notch, very similar to the radial notch on the ulna over here down by the radius. What would we call that notch on the radius where the head of the ulna fits in? And just by knowing nomenclature, if this notch on the ulna is called the radial notch, the notch down over here on the radius is called the ulnar notch, right? So the ulnar notch is on the radius, the radial notch is on the ulna. So that tells you what bones come together. All right, so that's a nice uniaxial pivot. Condyloid, okay, biaxial. So there's two axes of rotations. And where is a good thing? Metacarpophalangeal joint. All right, so that's between a wrist bone and a finger. Okay, between a hand bone and a digit. All right, so here are the metacarpals, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. These are bones you find in your hand. Here are bones that are in your fingers, right, your digits. Here is kind of a fancy joint, almost looks like a ball and socket joint, but not quite. I haven't told you what that is yet, but you'll see what a ball and socket joint is real soon. And so think of two axes, one from right to left, one from right to left, and one from anterior to posterior. So this proximal phalanx can rotate what, anteriorly, posteriorly? We call that what, flexion, extension, maybe even hyperextension. And here is the lateral rotation, which we call, when I spread your fingers apart, give you the peace sign. Okay, that is abduction. When you bring your fingers together, you're adding your fingers together. That is adduction, right, at the metacarpal phalangeal joint. Biaxial motion. You can do a couple kinds of things. Saddle joint. And saddle joint. This is pretty fancy. Okay, here's a saddle joint right here between a carpal and the first metacarpal. This is the joint that allows opposition to take place. And again, it's a biaxial kind of rotation. Some guys might kind of recognize this as a particular kind of joint between parts of your automobile. What is this? Does this remind anybody? Or maybe even in your toolbox, you might have a little device like this. They would call this a universal socket or a universal joint, right? So that the drive shaft, when you hook it up to your transmission, it can change angulations without breaking the drive shaft, right? So take a look at a universal joint sometime, and you will see that there are two axes of rotation. Okay, and so for both adduction, abduction, flexion, and extension, when you add these things together, you can get an opposition kind of motion. Right? And you see the shape of this joint kind of looks like a saddle, so they call it a saddle joint. Too bad they just don't call it a universal joint. Okay, okay. And then the last one, ball and socket. Ball and socket joint. Here's a ball and socket. We're familiar with some of these. So the ball. Tell me two places where you would find a ball in a ball and socket joint. Give me the names of some parts of a bone. Or give me two bones first. What two bones would you have a ball and socket joint on? There's only two. The humerus and the femur. The ball on a humerus and femur is called the head, right? Femoral head or humeral head. And say the humeral head fits into what socket? I even see it on this illustration here. It would be the glenoid cavity or glenoid fossa, right? I kind of like fossa. Cavity to me means really big and substantial. This glenoid fossa right here is not very deep, which gives a lot of dexterity to the shoulder. But since the shoulder has that dexterity, what is sacrificed at the shoulder? Strength. The shoulder is not a very strong joint because the head of the humerus doesn't fit very deeply into the glenoid fossa, right? Okay, so that's a nice ball and socket joint. For the femur, what would be the ball of the femur in this particular type of joint? Would be the head of the femur, and the head of the femur fits into what socket? You should be able to tell me. What's the name of the socket that the head of the femur fits into? The acetabulum. Fantastic. And we even talked about that in lecture last time because I mentioned Bo Jackson, right, and there's that special ligament that goes across. Okay, so those are the shapes of some important joints. And there's one last thing that I want to show you, and this is important, and that is the knee joint. We're not going to spend a lot of time on the shoulder, but shoulder is important to know about, interesting to know about if you want to study on your own, but I think in the study guide, I only see the knee right here. So let's go find a knee. And we actually looked at the knee. Oh, before we get to the knee, okay, I said that there are some joints that have a special feature called, right, an articular disc, like in your knees, which we're going to get to in a second, but I showed you already, those are the menisci, fibrocartilage, meniscus right in that synovial joint. The temporomandibular joint has a meniscus, and I forgot about this one, it's noteworthy, right? The joint between the manubrium and the clavicle, that's a synovial joint, and there is an articular disc in that joint as well. Okay, and that helps stabilize the joint. And you can see a really strong joint capsule because the manubrium and the clavicle here don't match up really all that well. And that's why this articular disc is there and a very strong joint capsule. All right, so let's go to a knee. Temporomandibular joint. Ah, there's that nice articular disc. Where's another one? Shoulder, we're going to go over. And then one feature on the shoulder that you probably should know something about, and that is the glenoid labrum, right, which helps deepen the glenoid fossa a little bit. But the labrum is still nonetheless soft tissue. It's easily damaged. Okay, so here I see a joint. What kind of joint are we looking at right here? Can you see what part of the body we're looking at? It's a knee. All right, and how many bones are we looking at? Just give me a number. How many bones are we looking at? I like four. I see a patella, one. I see a tibia, two. I see a fibula, three. And I see the femur. I see four. So I see four nice bones right here. And I see a connection between the patella and the tibial tuberosity on the tibia. Right, so that's a bone-to-bone connection. What do we call a bone-to-bone connection? Just a generic term for a bone-to-bone connection. It's a ligament, yep. And then here is a muscle-to-bone connection. This is a tendon, right? So here we can see tendons and ligaments really nicely. This big, powerful muscle on our anterior thigh is what we call the quadriceps femoris. It's got four parts. I only see three parts to it right here, but in lab we're going to see all four parts. And that's an important muscle. It definitely helps stabilize the joint. It goes all the way across the knee. Even though this muscle inserts into the patella is attached to the tibia via the patellar ligament. I also see some other ligaments that are lateral. Here is to the joint, right? So here is the lateral, collateral ligament. And you could also call this the fibular collateral ligament because the fibula is lateral, right? So either way. And here is a ligament that goes from the femur down to the tibia. We could call this the tibial collateral ligament or the medial collateral ligament. It's the same name. All right, so, and all these others right here, I don't really want you to know. So let's actually dissect this knee apart a little bit. That still looks complicated. Let's look here. All right, so all the muscles have been taken off the illustration. The quadriceps tendon has been cut, so the patella is reflected anterior a little bit so we can look deep inside the knee. And we've kind of looked at this knee already, this particular illustration. So you see the hyaline cartilage on the epiphyses of the bones and the patellar surface, right? So this helps make a nice synovial joint. Here we see the articular discs in the knee. We call that a meniscus. And you got to know which one is the right and which is the left. Okay, and you'd know that because the tibia is the, what, medial or lateral bone in the leg. It's the medial. So here's the medial meniscus. Here's the lateral meniscus. Fibrocartilage. Here are the ligaments that we looked at before. Okay, running superior posterior, one from the femur down to the fibula, the other from the femur down to the tibia. These are what we call the collateral ligaments. You could either call it the lateral collateral ligament or fibular or medial collateral ligament or tibial. Has anyone ever heard of a lateral collateral ligament before? Ever? TV show? Watch baseball games, soccer games, football games? All right, they talk about these routinely because, okay, in sports, these ligaments are damaged routinely, right? They're ripped, they're torn apart, and then somebody has to have a knee rehabilitated when that happens. Okay, so what's the job of this lateral collateral ligament? It puts strain, tension, laterally on the knee. Right, and it prevents the leg from moving toward midline, right? Because remember, the knee should just be a hinge joint. It should be just flexion and extension, right? So the leg shouldn't move medially. That would be adduction. And it's the lateral collateral ligament that prevents that motion. But if somebody's hit really hard and their thigh is held stationary and the leg is bent in toward their body, then that is the ligament that gets ripped, right? And same thing for this medial collateral ligament. If somebody's thigh is held stationary and you get hit from the inside of the leg so that it moves laterally, then the medial collateral ligament gets ripped, right? Because that's what its job is. It stabilizes the knee from abduction and adduction. All right, now what about the knee and the jaw? All right, what do you call that motion when you move your jaw anteriorly? We talked about it. You stick your lower teeth out like that. don't break a tooth though. That is protraction. When you move your mandible back in, that is retraction. So think of that motion and now transpose it to the knee. Should your knee move that way? Holding your thigh stationary, should your leg be able to move anterior to your thigh? Should it move like that? Okay. Remember, the knee should be what? Flexion and extension. Your leg should not move anterior to your thigh if your thigh is stationary. And the opposite is true as well. Your leg should not move posteriorly when your thigh is stationary, because your knee should just be what? A hinge, back and forth, flexion and extension. So what's in your knee to prevent protraction and retraction? And it's the ligaments that are deep inside the knee, and notice that they cross over each other, so we call these cruciate ligaments. I'm sure anybody that's interested in any kind of athletics knows something about cruciate ligaments because they're damaged routinely. Right, the one that's anterior is what we, from the intercondylar notch to the intercondylar eminence on the tibia. This anterior one is what we call the anterior cruciate ligament. The one that courses posteriorly is what we call the posterior cruciate ligament. All right, so that's the knee. We've got good knees in lab. We'll have knees on the practicum. And a knee is really nice and simple because, to me, I just see a nice grid, right, or a matrix, right? I see things over here, I see things over there, I see things up here, things over here. So it's really easy to place all of these different ligaments and tendons because it just fits into a really nice grid. The tricky thing, when you look at this femur, when I look at this femur right here, I cannot tell what's medial and lateral because I don't see the head of the femur. But there is something that will tell you what's medial and lateral, and what's that? The tibia and fibula. And so just memorize that the tibia right here is medial. And that's easy because you can always palpate your leg and feel that tibia right there. You can't feel the fibula because it's under way too many muscles to palpate. Okay. All right, so that's it for this particular chapter. So we're going to focus on the knee in lecture and also in lab. Questions? Anybody have a rebuilt knee in here? Anybody rebuilt knee? Everybody have all your meniscus and everything already? Still nice and healthy? That's good. Okay. So, I guess one last thing. How do you maintain the health of your knee? Okay. Well, the health of your knee is that you only perform flexion and extension with it. Don't try to abduct or adduct, right? And what maintains the health of the knee are the muscles that work across the knee. So if there's ever damage to the knee, it's really difficult to rehabilitate these ligaments and the menisci. The best way to rehabilitate a joint and to make it strong is to work on the muscles that are on either side of the joint. Okay, so that's so important. And what does that refer to? That refers to exercise. Okay. All right, so I'm going to put joints away, and we're ready to look at another pretty interesting tissue, and that is a tissue that actually moves around a lot, and that is muscle tissue. So muscle is specialized to shorten or contract, and if it's skeletal muscle, the opposite ends of that muscle are attached to two different bones. When the muscle contracts, then those bones move together. Right? They get pulled closer together. Right, so I see some nice muscles here, biceps, I see a brachialis, I see deltoid, I see pectoralis, and then opposite to the biceps brachii is the triceps. So there's a lot going on in this picture. All right, so let's get an introduction. The functions of muscle tissue. Well, we said motion, right, because it's attached to your skeleton, moves your skeleton around, but it also does some other important things. You are not really moving around right now, maybe just a little bit, but basically you're just stationary. Nonetheless, you are still using a lot of muscles. What? To just maintain posture. So muscles are important for maintaining posture so that you don't move bones in a way that will damage them, right, to protect joints. Even when you're not moving, muscles have to contract just to protect joints and to maintain posture. All right, so, and that is the third important feature of muscle, Right? When muscles are strong across a joint, that stabilizes a joint. When muscles are really weak across a joint, then the joint becomes unstable. That's an important thing. And then when muscles contract, right, they use energy up. All that energy is not used for muscle contraction. Some of that energy is converted into heat, right? And so it's generation of body heat. And how could you prove to me that when you use a muscle, you generate heat? We might have to do that. Everybody might have to come down to the front of the class and we'll do a couple sprints up the stairs. What would happen if you were to do that? Besides passing out. Before you passed out, what would happen? You would start sweating. Yeah, you would have some pain, right, because of the metabolism in those muscles, but you'd start sweating. And sweating is an indication of an increase in body temperature. Sweating is there to cool your body down, right? So using those muscles generates body heat, and our body temperature should not vary much. And so as these muscles generate heat, another mechanism has to come into play to cool our body down, to maintain your constant temperature, and that is sweating. Okay, so muscles do produce heat when they contract. There are some special functional characteristics which separate muscle tissue from other tissues. Some of these special properties, well, one we talked about is that it can shorten. We call that contractility. Muscles can shorten with power. We call that contractility. And if there's no input to a skeletal muscle, if you're just relaxing in your mind, since skeletal muscle is under voluntary control, right, it's just relaxed. But if ever you wanted to move your skeleton, muscle can become excited with your voluntary control. So muscle is excitable. Bones aren't excitable. Tendons aren't excitable, right? Your fingernails, your integument is not excitable, but skeletal muscle is. All right, and not only can muscle contract, so here I see a biceps, if we look at the picture, I see a biceps contracting, and it's flexing the forearm. And then over here, I mentioned here is the triceps. When the biceps contracts or shortens, guess what has to happen to the triceps? Okay, or when the triceps contracts, what has to happen to the biceps? Right? When the biceps contracts and gets shorter, it means that the triceps over here has to get longer. Otherwise, there will be no motion. Right? Or if the triceps contracts get shorter, then the biceps over here has to get longer. We call that extensibility. Muscles are extensible. They can be stretched out. Another way of saying extensibility is what? Stretchability, but that's really not a good college-level term, right? Extensible. So muscles can contract, but you can also stretch them back out to what their normal length is. And then the last one right here, elasticity. Who knows something about elasticity? Elasticity. Oh, yeah, you should know a lot, because we talked about elastic fibers. What's the cool thing about an elastic fiber? You can stretch it a little bit. Okay, not a tremendous amount, but you can stretch it a little bit, and then when you let go, what happens? It goes back to its original length. The same thing for a muscle. When this biceps contracts over here, it stretches the triceps because it is extensible, and then when the biceps relaxes, what happens to this triceps because there's elasticity? It goes back to its original length, right, because it has some elastic properties as well. Okay, so these are some important considerations. And from histology, remember there are three kinds of muscle. One, voluntary, which is skeletal. Two, involuntary, which would be cardiac muscle and smooth muscle. They have different structures. They have different machines on the inside, so they behave a little bit differently. They're controlled a little bit differently. And since a skeletal muscle cell in our body that makes up the biceps right here really was hundreds of cells at one time that have come together to make a really long filament, we call a skeletal muscle a fiber. A muscle fiber and a skeletal muscle cell are exactly the same thing. And a muscle fiber has many nuclei. It's kind of a strange human cell because it is multinucleate. All those nuclei from all those progenitor cells still remain inside of a muscle fiber. Okay, let's look at how we want to characterize muscle. So here's the femur, and here's a muscle attached to the femur. So what kind of muscle does this have to be? I heard it. It is? Could it be, is it skeletal, cardiac, or smooth? Since it's attached to the skeleton, it is skeletal muscle under voluntary control. All right, and A muscle to bone connection is called a tendon. So here's a tendon that is connective tissue. It's continuous with some connective tissue that surrounds this whole muscle. And that's what we call the epimysium. Epimysium surrounds this whole muscle. This might be a good example of one of the, maybe one of the hamstrings in the back of the leg, for instance, like the biceps femoris. You got a biceps brachii in the arm, biceps femoris in your thigh. Okay, so here is a whole big muscle. Sometimes we might call this the muscle belly because it kind of looks like a stomach in some sense, right? And if we break this whole muscle down, you see structures. If we cut that muscle open, you see structures inside the muscle. Or does it look all homogeneous right here? You see any structures in here? I see structures, okay? Those structures that you can see right here and right here are what we call fascicles. All right, so what is the building block of a whole big muscle? It is a fascicle, right? Fascicle is a building block of a muscle. And there is a membrane or connective tissue sheath around a fascicle, right? And the fascicle has what we call the perimysium surrounding it. So epimysium, epi means like where's the epidermis? On top of, right? Epimysium is the connective tissue sheath on top of the whole muscle. Mesium just means muscle. Right? The one around a fascicle is what we call the perimysium. Peri means surrounding a fascicle. And if we were to pull a fascicle out, do you see any structure inside a fascicle? These fascicles, I don't see any structure. But if we zoom in and look over here, here's a fascicle. Do you see any structures inside a fascicle? I see structure inside a fascicle. These things right here are the individual muscle cells. So here is a muscle cell. Here's a muscle cell. And my goodness, and then here's one that's kind of pulled out from the fascicle. That's a muscle cell. What's another name for a skeletal muscle cell? That is a muscle fiber, right? Because it's long and narrow, like a filament, okay? So the building block of a fascicle is what? A fiber. Put a bunch of muscle fibers or muscle cells together, you get a fascicle. Put a whole bunch of fascicles together, you get a muscle. These are building blocks. All right. Now, let's look inside of a muscle cell. I can see that it has many nuclei. I see one here, I see one here, I see one here. It's multinucleate. That shouldn't freak you out because we know that already. But furthermore, do you see any structures inside of a muscle fiber? I see more structures. Okay? And these structures are really important. These are the organelles of contraction. Organelles of contraction. I didn't mention these when we talked about organelles, but I should. I should go back and modify my slides. These organelles for contraction are called myofibrils. So how do we put a muscle fiber together? We put myofibrils in there. And how do we build a fascicle? By putting muscle fibers together. How do we build a muscle? By putting fascicles together. All right, so let's zoom in to a muscle. To a muscle fiber. Here's a muscle fiber. Right, I can see 1, 2, 3, 4 nuclei, has many nuclei. And then here's that organelle, and it kind of looks like a fiber too, a filament. This is the myofibril. Oh, and look at all these mitochondria inside this muscle fiber. Why does this muscle fiber have a lot of mitochondria? Because the muscle fiber needs energy in order to contract. And that energy comes from ATP, right, which comes from all of these mitochondria in the skeletal muscle cell. So here's a myofibril, and I see many myofibrils inside the muscle cell. So the myofibril is the organelle for contraction, and you see a repeating pattern, right? There are special machines inside every myofibril, and we're going to call these special machines a sarcomere. And notice that all the sarcomeres within a muscle cell line up perfectly with each other, and that's what gives, right, skeletal muscle this striated appearance. Because all of the sarcomeres and all of these myofibrils just line up perfectly with each other. So it's a very easy pattern to see. All right. And now if we look inside of a myofibril, there's not a lot of magnification here, but do you see any structure inside of a myofibril? Can you see any structure in there or does it look... Oh, tell you what, let's look here. Do you see any structures inside there? Maybe I'll have to turn the light down because I'm done dancing around. There. Okay, do you see any structures? If we can have a nice cross-section through a myofibril, I see some structures in there. Hopefully, we'll see something on the next slide. Yeah, take a look at this. Take a look at this. All right. Let me flip a couple more slides. Okay, I got to go back. Okay. All right, so here's the muscle cell or fiber. Here's the myofibril, which makes up a muscle fiber. And then here is just an illustration of a myofibril. And here's that repeating pattern, okay, from here to here. And then it repeats itself from here to over here, which is off the slide. So here is that unit of that repeating pattern. And the slide tells you what we call this repeating unit. It is a sarcomere. Whenever you hear that word sarco, you should think of skeletal muscle. Like a sarcoma would be a tumor in a skeletal muscle, for instance, cancer in a skeletal muscle. So the sarcomere is the structural and functional unit of contraction. What's the structural and functional unit of life? A cell. Yeah, what's the structural and functional unit of compact bone? That was an osteon. Osteon. Right, so if you know what an osteon is, you know everything pretty much about compact bone. If you know something about a cell, you know pretty much everything about life. Right, because that's the basic building block. And if you understand the sarcomere, just this one little unit between here and here, then you know pretty much everything about contraction in a skeletal muscle. All right, so we're going to focus our attention on a sarcomere. And if we look inside a myofibril, do you see structures where I have the cursor right now? Do you see some structures there? The answer is yes. So what are these structures? I see some really big dots and some thin dots, and they probably are a different color too. All right, so here is the myofibril. It's made up of myofilaments. These small little dots right here are actually filaments. We call these myofilaments. All right, so let's put a muscle together. If we take a bunch of myofilaments that I have right here and put them together, what do we get? We get this whole big long tube. That's the organelle for contraction. Put myofilaments together, you get a myofibril. If we put myofibrils together, we get a muscle fiber. If we put muscle fibers together, we get a fascicle. And we put a bunch of fascicles together, maybe we put a bunch of fascicles together, which I see right here, we get a muscle. Right? And all of these different connective tissue sheets all join together, right, to form this tendon so that if any of these muscles contracts, it all pulls on the same kind of connective tissue which ends up pulling on this bone. They all just kind of fuse together. All right, so let's look at some of these myofilaments. There are basically two important kinds. There are some that are thick. Can you see that this one here is thick? And in between the thick filaments are some that are blue. All right, but they're what? They're thin, right? So there are thick filaments and thin filaments, and you have to know the name of the thick filaments. These are what we call myosin. It's a kind of protein. The thin filaments are always going to be called actin. And notice that the actin and myosin filaments always interdigitate. They are always right next to each other. So if you look at the end of a myofibril, here I see a myosin. What filament is completely surrounding this myosin myofilament? It is the actin. Every myosin is surrounded by a number of actin proteins. All right? And what can you tell me about this actin right here? It is surrounded by myosin. It's a really kind of interesting, unique arrangement that these filaments, the thick and thin filaments, just surround each other. That's going to be important for muscle contraction. All right, what else do I notice? I see the zigzag line. That's the endpoints of a sarcomere. And it's called the Z-disc because it goes all the way across this little tube right here. And it's called the Z-disc because it's the endpoints of a sarcomere. And what's the endpoint of our alphabet? It is the letter Z. Maybe it was named because of the zigzag pattern. I'm not sure. But either way, it makes sense to me. What myofilament is attached to the endpoints of a sarcomere? I only see one. And it is the actin, right? And where do you find the myosin? Kind of floating on the inside, the interior, the middle of a sarcomere. There are some things that hold these myosin filaments in the right place, and it helps make up a little band right here that we call the H zone. Wherever we have myosin that blocks a lot of light, we call that the A band, and where we only have actin, we're going to call that the I band. All right, so one way to remember the A band is that when we look under or through a microscope, okay, I can see, so here is the Z disk. Here's a Z disk. In the middle is a sarcomere. And can you see that there is a dark band right here where we would have myosin? All right. And fortunately, there is a nice A in the word dark. And so we call that the A band. And here is the I band. It's lighter. Fortunately, there's an I in the word light to help you remember that. That's not how it was named, but that's really close. That will help you remember. Right? It has to do with the optical properties of these two different layers, but just a little bit different conception. And then here is what? That H zone, once again. And then the Z disks. So I can see thin filaments don't block very much light. Thick filaments block a lot of light. All right, so how many different... Oh, here you can see how the myofilaments surround each other very nicely. Okay. Let's look at this illustration. All right, Z disk is a sarcomere. The two important filaments in a sarcomere are the thin filaments. What's another name for thin filament? Actin. And here's the thick filament. Another name is called myosin. And notice that they are right up against each other, right? They're nice and straight proteins, and they line up with each other. Every myosin is surrounded 360 degrees by actin. Actin is surrounded by myosin. Okay, the Z disk, the endpoints. And remember, we said that skeletal muscle is extensible. So when you pull it and let go, it goes back to its normal length. And that's because there are some elastic fibers within a sarcomere. And I see it right here and right here, kind of drawn as a little spring. These are what we call titin proteins. A titin protein is not responsible for contraction, right? It's just responsible for elasticity of a muscle if you stretch it. Okay, so I don't make too big a deal out of this titin molecule. Is it labeled? Oh, yeah, it is. Okay, so you got actin, myosin, titin. Here is that M line that stabilizes the myosin. The titin molecules also help stabilize the myosin, helps keep it positioned right in the center of the sarcomere. The actin is very strongly positioned within the sarcomere because it's attached to the Z disk. All right, so what did we say the function of skeletal muscle is, or muscle in general, is to shorten or contract, right? And so in order for muscle to contract, what actually contracts is a sarcomere. It shortens, right? So the Z disk on one side of the sarcomere has to get pulled closer to the Z disk on the other side. And the question that I have that we got to answer next time is which one of these proteins actually shortens when a sarcomere shortens? Is it an actin molecule that gets shorter? Or is it a myosin molecule that gets shorter? Or maybe both of these things get shorter that pull the Z disks together in a sarcomere? All right, so next time I would want for you all to maybe tell me, how is it that the sarcomere gets shorter? Which of these proteins actually gets shorter? Okay? All right, so look at how a muscle is put together. Okay, and know the organelle of contraction, which is the myofibril. How you put a myofibril together, it's with what? These myofilaments, right? And that's the smallest thing. So if we put myofilaments together, we get a myofibril. Put myofibrils together, we get a fiber. Put fibers together, we get a fascicle. Put fascicles together, we get a muscle, like a biceps brachii. Okay, so that's it for lecture for this week. And I'm glad you guys have a lot of time over the weekend before another lecture. Okay? Don't forget, when is your next exam in here? Yeah, which is 1 week from today. Okay? Study guide for the lecture exam. If you're having problems with that or any problems with Blackboard, email me. I'll probably be out of email range starting tomorrow morning. So if you got a problem with Blackboard, you got to let me know like tonight or today sometime. Okay, sign-in sheet is going around. Go ahead, sign that and bring it down to the front of the class.